stations and all that stuff, and they have the infrastructure, right? And they have drinking water.
Unfortunately, we can't all move there. But anyway, that's well, we are all out of time. So once again, Jacqueline Keeler, thank you so much. Always good to talk to you and hear from you.
You too.
Okay. Bye, everybody. Signing off.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude?
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
FM Community Radio.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KABU. Consider adding KABU to your will or add KABU as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KABU along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KABU to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kabu.fm to notify us of your plans.
Horseshoe crabs. Yes, I said horseshoe crabs. What do they have to do with human health and the environment? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
What's going on?
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Call a code.
Get an ambulance from the nurse's station.
Heart's still working, means synapses are still firing.
We just need to get a message through.
There's not going to be a war by Russia to conquer the United States. There's not going to be a war by China to conquer the United States. No country is going to conquer the United States. The United States is destroying itself because of the size of its military.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy, and that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
I feel pretty confident in guessing that everybody listening to this podcast has never for once thought about horseshoe crabs. But our guest today has written an entire book about horseshoe crabs. I've seen them. I think they're pretty cool. They look remarkably prehistoric, and they are not the crabs we eat. But until being informed of this new book, Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology, and Human Health, I had not a clue as to their importance to things like the COVID vaccines and human health. And unfortunately, a law of capitalism applies to horseshoe crabs. The demand is huge, and the supply is dwindling to a danger point. Why care about horseshoe crabs? Well, you'll find a reason as you listen. Our guest author, Bill Sargent, wrote a new book called Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology and Human Health. He's a consultant for NOVA Science Series and the author of 27 books about science and the environment, including Shallow Waters, A Year on Cape Cod's Pleasant Bay, which won the Winship Penn New England Award, Storm Surge, A Coastal Village Battles the Rising Atlantic, and Terror by Error, The COVID Chronicles, which was the first book to investigate whether COVID came about because of a lab accident. Formerly director of the Baltimore Aquarium and a research assistant at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, he's taught at the Briarwood Center for Marine Biology and at Harvard University. Well, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. And it's very nice to be talking to somebody from New Hampshire because you're familiar with horseshoe crabs.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, if you go just right around the corner from Portsmouth to Great Bay,
yes,
that's one of the most significant, largest northern population of horseshoe crabs on the East Coast. And if you go there under the full moon or the new moon in April, May, June, and sometimes a little bit in July, there'll be dozens and dozens of horseshoe crabs, sometimes as many as hundreds of horseshoe crabs that are up on the beach laying their eggs. It gives you sort of a sense of creation because this has been going on for 450 million years. So way before there were birds, fish, dinosaurs, all the animals that were familiar with, they were coming up on land, and the only thing on land were little mosses and ferns and some dragonflies with about a 3-foot long wingspan. And now each one of those horseshoe crabs, if you keep it alive and use it for lysate, is worth $1,500. If you chop them up and use them for bait, they're worth about 30 cents a pound. But what we're doing, particularly in the mid-Atlantic states, is they have been chopping them up and using them for bait for eels and conchs and various things like that. But now we're starting to tighten the regulations so that we'll only be using them for lysate.
Yes, and I will confess, never heard of lysate before. And if you haven't seen a horseshoe crab, think about, you know, an early version of a tank in World War I. They sort of look like that. They're very, I can see why they haven't changed in all these millions of years, because it's pretty well protected. It's this big,
absolutely,
big shell. Well, unless one is in deep denial about the ever more dangerous effects of over-harvesting natural resources in these days of increased environmental consciousness and concern, we may be aware of dwindling corals and other threats to the stability of our oceans, but the horseshoe crab... Why is the status of the horseshoe crab something that ought to be on our radar? And I guess this leads right into the lysate. What the heck is lysate, and why is it important, something that ought to be on our radar?
Yeah, well, everybody who's listening to us, lives have been protected by horseshoe crab blood. Whenever anything's going to come in contact with the human blood system, whether it's a syringe or a vaccine or an antibody test or a pacemaker, anything like that has to be tested to make sure that it's free of bacteria. And the way they do that is with the horseshoe crab test. And so it's the most commonly used medical procedure in the world that's all based on a single species of wild animal. And that animal has been declining up and down the East Coast, both because they're used for bait and because they're used for the lysate. Theoretically, you should be able to, you know, go out, catch the crabs, bring them into the lab, bleed them, and then return them back to the wild with no mortality. Uh-huh. But often industrial conditions, the trucks don't show up, the crabs are left out in the sun, and you'll have very high mortality.
So drawing their blood, I have no idea how one draws blood from a horseshoe crab. It doesn't necessarily kill the crab. So, and I wonder, how did anybody ever figure out that horseshoe crab blood could be so useful?
Yeah, well, let's see. The first part of your question: how do you bleed a horseshoe crab? If you look at a horseshoe crab, they fold, and in the middle, yes, of that fold, there's a little sort of a hinge. And so what they do is they put them in a wooden rack, and then they you know, put a syringe in that in the leathery little tissue of the fold, and then they let the blood flow out, and it's a bright blue copper-based blood. It's blue blood, and it's a cobalt blue. It's actually quite beautiful.
Wow.
And as soon as it comes in contact with the air or with gram-negative bacteria, then it turns this cobalt blue. And so that's basically the test itself. What they do is they take the blood, they dry it, they make what's called limulus amebocyte lysate, and then they simply add water to that. And then all the vaccines that we've been using for COVID and all of the antibody tests all had to be tested to make sure they were free of bacteria. And the way they were doing this was with the horseshoe crab test. And I forget the second part of your question.
Yeah. It's amazing that anybody discovered that. So this lysate is in the crab, the blood of the horseshoe crab. And how important is that? What's the role of the lysate in the fight against COVID?
Well, it's the test for gram-negative bacteria. And we've been using that. Formerly, the companies that made vaccines would have huge colonies of live rabbits. And all the vaccines had to be, they would inject them, the vaccine into a rabbit. And if a rabbit kicked over and died, they knew that it was contaminated with bacteria. And it was very costly. You know, you had to have these colonies of, you know, hundreds and thousands of rabbits.
Yeah.
So after the swine flu epidemic in 1976, they tested the two tests, both the rabbit test and the horseshoe crab test, and they found out that the horseshoe crab test was much easier to use, it was much more sensitive and much less expensive. So that the Food and Drug Administration accepted that as the standard test for bacteria.
Yeah.
A similar kind of thing came up with COVID. And you'll remember that, you know, the FDA has had a huge role in that. They basically made the decision that we would continue to use limulus lysate. We would continue to use the horseshoe crab blood as opposed to using this new sort of razzle-dazzle gene splicing to make an artificial form of lysate. And this would protect the crabs, but it so far we don't know that it is as effective and as sensitive as the whole animal test. So they decided to, you know, stick with the lysate. And I don't agree with the Food and Drug Administration very often, but I agree with them there. Hmm. I think you didn't want to, you know, switch horses in midstream. Because you had 30 years of experience with the lysate and you knew that it was very effective, but they've only got a couple years worth of trials with the artificial one. So I think eventually we will adopt that, and that will both protect the horseshoe crabs, and it will also protect a number of endangered shorebirds that are dependent on horseshoe crab eggs for their migrations.
Interesting. Yeah, it all mixes in, as a lot of us have learned through the decades. And certainly multinational pharmaceutical conglomerates are both appreciated for having the capital to do life-saving research and development. But there's also the concern about unintended consequences of self-regulating industries having great control over the Earth's limited natural resources. And the way you described the crabs, you know, piling up to do their mating ritual, I can picture a lot of horseshoe crabs. How close are the crabs to becoming endangered, and where do they fit into the ecological balance? You described a little bit of that.
Well, they're really crucial to areas like Great Bay and Pleasant Bay, all the estuaries up and down the East Coast, because they, you know, they eat a lot of detritus, they eat a lot of, you know, worms and various things like that. Very few animals actually eat the horseshoe crabs themselves.
I bet.
Lots and lots of them. Yeah. I've been asked sometimes, you know, you get asked to give recipes for, you know, various cookbooks, and I've included one for horseshoe crab chowder. And when you go down the list of ingredients until you get to, a pound of crow meat, then I think people realize that they've been had.
Yeah, you look at a horseshoe crab, forget about it. You can't eat that.
Right.
Okay, anyway, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah. So they're very, very important to the environment. And, you know, but they're particularly important to species like red knots. And this is a species that migrates from Tierra del Fuego in the tip of South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle.
Oh my.
And all of them, 80% of all the red knots in the world are on the beaches of Delaware Bay when the horseshoe crabs are mating. And they eat over 40 tons of horseshoe crab eggs. And that gives them the fuel to make the rest of their migration up to the Arctic Circle, and they can start laying their eggs.
Well, good for them. I'll choose something else to keep me going. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. And we're actually talking about horseshoe crabs with the William Sargent, author of a new book, Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology and Human Health. And you mentioned how, why is the horseshoe crab blood so profitable? And, you know, is it hard? Well, I guess it's not that hard to get it once you know how to do that and find that hinge on the crab, which is pretty easy to do. But how profitable is it for these pharmaceutical companies?
It's extremely profitable. And yes, it is, you know, it's very easy to get the blood. Then there's a certain amount of sort of biochemical rigmarole that has to go on to make the lysate. You have to spin out the cells, and that causes the cells to lyse, which means they break open. So you get the limulus. It's called limulus amebocyte lysate. Limulus comes from Limulus polyphemus, which is the Latin name of the crab, and the amebocytes are the cells. They have we have about 26 different cells that are all part of our antibody system. Horseshoe crabs have a single what's called an amebocyte cell, which is like an amoeba, and it. If the horseshoe crab gets a wound, the amebocyte cells will migrate to the area and coagulate and keep the infection out. So it's a very primitive. It was the first immune system in the animal kingdom, and it's very primitive, but it's worked for 450 million years.
So what is the threat to the crabs? I mean, we've heard of overfishing, and you know it's kind of frightening out there, you know, with all the plastics in the ocean and overfishing in general. So how close are these crabs to becoming endangered?
Well, they are declining up and down the East Coast. There's a few areas where they're actually holding their own or increasing, and those are the areas, for instance, South Carolina has passed the regulation that horseshoe crabs can only be used for lysate, so they can no longer be used for bait. And I think this should be adapted by all of the East Coast states.
Uh-huh.
And I used to, you know, mention this on radio shows, and I'd get, you know, I expected to get all kinds of pushback from fishermen. And actually, they called in and they said, no, it's not a problem. We can use spider crabs or other things for bait, and they work just as well. So I think that would have a significant impact on protecting the crabs.
So, you know, and I've wondered, you know, here in Portsmouth and along the East Coast, it's been tough for local fishermen to have, you know, it's tough work anyway, but to have regulations, they don't like the regulations necessarily, but, you know, most of them recognize, hey, we got to have fish in the future. So they're not, it's not a threat to the enterprise of the local fishermen. They're not affected by regulations surrounding horseshoe crabs adversely?
No, I think, and you know, so far the regulations have been, you know, fairly mild or non-existent. What some states are starting to do, in some areas, and I think this makes a lot of sense, is, they don't allow people to collect the crabs when they're coming up to lay their eggs, which kind of seems obvious actually. But what that does is if you're collecting the crabs while they're laying the eggs, what you do is you take those females out of the breeding population. So you might not notice that the numbers of adult crabs is declining, but you will notice that the number of immature crabs absolutely plummets. There was a court case. It was a federal court case in 2000 in Pleasant Bay, which is where I grew up and have studied horseshoe crabs for the past, I'm not going to tell you how many years. Mm-hmm. I remember as a kid, you would look along the edge of the shore and you'd see hundreds and hundreds of little horseshoe crab shells. They shed their shell every year. And these were all about the size of a quarter. But then I started noticing in the late 1900s, you just didn't see any of these. There were plenty of large crabs in the bay, so nobody was concerned about the population of adult crabs, and nobody really noticed that there weren't any small crabs. And I finally got together with a friend of mine, George Buckley, who teaches at Harvard, and he brought his students down. And what we decided to do is we collected all the shells along a 100-meter transect, and whereas before you'd have hundreds and hundreds of crabs, we were only finding two or three crabs. And so the court case went ahead, and basically what was happening is people were collecting the crabs in the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is actually illegal because you're not allowed to make a profit from animals that you catch in a national seashore. But nobody knew this was happening for about 20 years. As a matter of fact, when it came out that it was happening, the head of the seashore said, what are we going to do? Chase them with our chase canoes? So what they did is they won the case. They stopped people from collecting the horseshoe crabs in the shallow waters of the Cape Cod National Seashore. And then the horseshoe crabs came back and, far faster than we expected. The following year and the year after that, you returned to having, hundreds of horseshoe crab shells along the shore again. So they bounced back incredibly quickly. And that, of course, is, that's the big lesson, particularly with marine animals, that if you give them half a break, they will jump back incredibly. You've probably been hearing about the whales that are feeding right offshore in northern Massachusetts and off Hampton Beach and in along the New Hampshire coast.
Yeah.
And they're feeding on the menhaden. Menhaden had been in decline not too many years ago, and then they passed some more stringent regulations and they've bounced back. So now there's just, huge schools of them, and you'll see the whales will be feeding on them, and seals and great white sharks and bass and bluefish, and everybody's out there, in the buffet.
Well, that's good to hear that, because sometimes, I mean, lots of these things you're talking about, I don't have a clue, but that we can bring these things back once, if you do it, if you stop, ridiculous harvesting and overfishing, yeah, and things like that, because we worry. I like to eat fish, and I'd like to have a lot of fish in the ocean for the future. So maybe there's a way around that. And in some ways, your book is kind of a sobering reflection on the unintended consequences of scientific progress. Did you mean for it to be that?
Yes, it is sort of a cautionary tale, and it's kind of interesting because, in the book, I look at some of the, there were a lot of corners that were cut, I think when you get a combination of, advanced biotech research plus capitalism, and you have to make money, people will cut corners, and that's what we found, and mistakes will be made. This sort of prepared me for, when COVID came out. I had actually just finished a manuscript about a book about tick-borne diseases. And and some of the accidents in research that could have led to that. And as soon as COVID came out, I realized, wow, that could be the same cause. And I was really prepared to see that because of doing the research on the horseshoe crab industry.
So those of us who are smart enough to take the vaccinations, which hopefully everybody listening has, I can't imagine not, should be, I don't know if we should go out and thank a horseshoe crab, but it has been very helpful indeed, and whoever thought about that. So what can the average person do? I mean, how much of a crisis might this be? And, you know, the book is Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology and Human Health. What should the average non-scientific person be doing? What can be done on this?
Well, I think of always, you know, the first thing is education. So, you know, learning about the issues and supporting legislation like only using the horseshoe crabs for lysate would be very important. The other thing that you can do is, you know, often when the horseshoe crabs are mating, they'll end up being flipped over on their back, and then they're vulnerable. You know, then seagulls can attack them, and then they will dry out. So you simply, if you just flip them over and let them release back into the water, you've saved a $1,500 animal.
And I feel like I've seen the same shape that horseshoe crabs are in fossils. You know, it's like a really primordial shape that is there. So the way you're talking about is things people can do at the state level, right? I mean, is that not where it should be? And I wonder if there's model legislation that you can point people to or places that have done it.
Well, South Carolina, and they did this quite early on when the industry was just getting started up in the 70s and 80s, and they passed legislation making it that you could only use the horseshoe crabs for lysate. You know, smaller areas, we passed the same sort of thing for Pleasant Bay on Cape Cod, where I grew up. And so there are similar things like that.
Well, great. If you're interested, dear listener, the book is Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology and Human Health. And we've been talking to author William Sargent. Thank you so much for being with us. And learning is really a lot of fun, I must say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And on the subject of the health of the oceans, this is a little tune called Surf's Up, written by Brian Wilson, but guitar by Jeff Beck. talk about radical shifts, we're going to move from horseshoe crabs to what happens next between the U.S. and China. What opportunities are there and what pitfalls? As we move from the problems of Trump to the opportunities of Biden, among the incredible number of urgent items on his plate is China. Are there any good options for the new president? Can we focus on human rights while improving trade relations with China? What policies might serve us, and what might cause them to react aggressively? What is the risk of Biden looking like we're being pushed around by Beijing? With us today to discuss President Biden's China conundrum is Michael Clare, the Five College Professor Emeritus of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College and a senior visiting fellow at the Arms Control Association. Michael Clare is the author of 15 books, the latest of which is All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. And he writes regularly for Tom Dispatch and The Nation. Well, thanks for being with us, Michael. And you write that China is in a more powerful position than ever to dictate the rules of the world economy, and that on so many fronts, dealing with China poses an enormous conundrum for America's new leadership team. Why is that, and how severe is the challenge of managing U.S. relations with China?
Here we are at the start of a new administration that wants to, you know, change everything about American policy, and we face a foreign rival, China, that is more powerful than ever and poses challenges on multiple fronts for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, militarily, diplomatically, technologically. I mean, let's face it, China is a rising power, and we haven't faced a challenger like this throughout American history. The Soviet Union was